welcome to modernisation. Just like those breakdancers at the Youth Olympics, we are moving with the times. Gone is the podcast format of old, and here we are, back with a bang, and hoping to cause just as much turbulence as in the Daily Mail comment section, watching a female Doctor Who for the very first time. We have news, we have views, and we have a panel boarder with three world records to her name. Welcome to Sporchville. Boom. Yes, listener, welcome to our latest episode where it's all change here. But some things have stayed the same, namely I am here and across the table, Will Moulton is here. How is everything?
I'm good. You talked about modernisation there, but the music is a little bit of a throwback to sort of old school 80s funk. Quite a fan.
It just describes us perfectly, doesn't it?
Yes, for children born in the 90s.
Yep. It's what I was listening to throughout the entirety of the 90s. Anyway, how's life been since we last met up to record?
I mean, it's slightly disappointing that summer's gone and autumn's here. The nights are drawing in. The leaves are on the floor.
And we've had to switch recording venue today.
Yep.
Because usually, as people know, we go to King's Place, but they are refurbing the cafe in there.
It's just a tad noisy.
It's just a tad. I've put on some sort of horrendous Hoover thing that was drowning us out, so we've moved literally to the library.
It's good to be back. It's a little bit quieter here, but hopefully we're not disturbing too many people.
Fingers crossed. Anyway, as we've mentioned, the Sportspiel format has changed. First up, we have our feature interview, which this time around features the incredible Lizzie Carr, a paddleboarder and adventurer with an amazing story to tell. Once that is over, part two features our all-new news roundup, where we go through some of the headline stories recently, as well as the ones that might have passed you by. Finally, we will finish up with our debate topic. And today, the question to answer is it right to have a women-only motor racing championship? And that comes after the announcement of the W Series this week. As ever, we have the timestamps in the show notes as well, so feel free to skip to whichever bit you want to listen to. But first, it's feature interview time. And this week is brought to you by Will Moulton.
It is, and we've gone for a completely different sport, completely different person to anyone we've ever interviewed before. So Lizzie Carr not only holds three world firsts as a paddleboarder, being the first woman to complete to paddleboard the length of England, the English Channel, and the most recently the Hudson River, completely unsupported. She is also a inspirational mental health speaker, a blogger, and most importantly, an environmental activist doing incredible work to try and rid the world of plastic pollution. She set up an initiative called Plastic Patrol to do just this, where she takes people out on the water on paddleboards and gets them to clean up their environment while also teaching them about the sport. She's just doing incredible things, and it's a really, really inspirational interview to hear someone talk with the passion she does. It's really special, so make sure you really tune in, listen to that, and hear what she has to say. It's made me think about how I'm going to, you know, make a difference, and I think it will do the same with you as well. So hello listeners, and welcome back to a brand new revamped Sportspiel. However, one thing that hasn't changed is that we are still able to invite on amazing guests to the show, and today's is no different as we welcome adventurer, endurance athlete, blogger and environmentalist Lizzie Carr, or Lizzie Outside as she is known to many. So first of all, just let me say a huge welcome to Lizzie and thank you so much for coming on.
Hello, thank you very much.
So some of you may have seen Lizzie in the news recently as she became the first person to successfully paddleboard the Hudson River, and that's all 275 kilometres of it in America. And that comes after she was also the first person to paddleboard the length of England unsupported in 2016 and the first person to paddleboard the English Channel the following year. But firstly, and I'm sure it's probably a question you've been asked many times, so apologies, but how did you get into the activity of paddleboarding in the first instance?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting journey, really. I started paddleboarding in about 2015. I was diagnosed with cancer, and I was sort of in recovery, and I went to go and stay in the Arbor City where my dad lived, really just to kind of have a rest and sort of get away from everything. And I saw somebody on a beach paddleboarding in the sea, and I thought, that looks really relaxing, and I'd really love to give that a go. So I borrowed a board from the local sailing club, went on the water out in the Sillies, and yeah, that was it. I was hooked. The rest was history. I just came back to London and started paddleboarding around London on the canals and rivers, and I've just kind of been addicted to it since.
And had you ever sort of seen or heard of paddleboarding before, or is it something completely brand new to you?
It was like completely brand new to me. I think I'd probably seen pictures on social media of sort of people doing it in the Caribbean, but I'd never seen anybody doing it until I was on the Isle of Scilly. And that was it.
Wow, and you mentioned that you were diagnosed with cancer, and I hope you don't mind me asking, but you were obviously very, very young at the time. Was it, how much of a shock was it to, you know, have been told that news?
Yeah, I was 26 when I was diagnosed. I was quite young. It completely blindsided me, to be honest. I just didn't expect it at all. I think, you know, like anybody, it's sort of the thing that happens to other people, to older people. It doesn't happen to you. So when it does, it's a huge shock.
Yeah, of course, I can imagine. And you mentioned there you used paddleboarding to aid your recovery. Sort of how much did it help you sort of get through the really tough times?
I really just decided to paddleboard as a way of restoring my fitness. It was low impact, so it was a way just to get stronger again. What I didn't realise at the time was how beneficial it would be to my mental health and sort of my well-being. And I think really that was what made me fall in love with it, is it was something that I could do to get fit, but it was also like meditation to me as well. And it had just so many benefits that were completely unexpected. And at the time, I really needed that, and I didn't realise how much until I found this kind of release through paddleboarding.
Yeah, of course. And you mentioned there how it impacts with your mental health, and you write a lot of inspirational posts for your followers sort of about how paddleboarding and sort of your life in general and mental health. Is that something that you feel like is really important, and that something that a lot of more people should be doing as well?
I've really learned through my opening up about mental health and anxiety that so many people are going through it as well, just very quietly. It's a really, really big issue. Every time I share a post about it, I get a huge, huge response from people. So I think it is important to sort of share ways about how I've tackled it and the mechanisms that I've found and sort of the things that I do that have helped me kind of get through it and manage it as time has gone on.
Of course. And have you sort of noticed that in the last few years, as more people have been talking about mental health and it's become less of a taboo? I know on Sportsbill we ran a whole week-long specials where we spoke to athletes and we ourselves opened up. Have you noticed that things are changing and improving?
I think by the fact that people are private messaging me or contacting me after I put a post up to say, you know, I'm struggling, how can I seek help, what can I do, what would you recommend? I don't think a few years ago people would have even had the guts to do that. So I still think there's definitely a stigma around it, but I do think we're coming into sort of a new age with it, and there is much more support for it, really, not just through kind of organisations, but other people. I think there's much more empathy from people now with anyone that does have mental health issues.
Of course, and you write a lot about how, you know, the sport of paddleboarding, as we've said already, helps with your mental health. What exactly is it? Is there sort of one particular thing that really, you know, helps you feel calm and less anxious, or is it just a multitude of things?
I think really it's a multitude of things. I mean, I can be really heavily anxious before I go out paddleboarding, and then I'll get on the water and, you know, spend a couple of hours just out in the freedom of the space of water, and I can come back a different person. It's sort of calmed me, relaxed me, and I think most importantly, it's given me a much more perspective. And I think probably a lot of people, if they exercise, understand that through their own activities. You know, a lot of people talk about when they run, it clears their head and it kind of gives them perspective back, and that's great. And I think my way of doing that has been through paddleboarding, and I feel lucky to have found that, really, because I think that's one of the challenges that people go through is, you know, trial and error of the things that they will help them cope with any mental health issues they've got. So that it just came at the right time for me.
And the sport of paddleboarding itself, I'm sure anyone who's seen your videos or has watched The Best People in the World in Action, it looks so simple. But for someone like me who has trouble standing on my own two feet in normal life, it looks like something I could never achieve. How difficult is it?
I think it's an amazing sport in that it's so accessible to everybody. I mean, when I first tried it, I'd just finished radiotherapy treatment. I was probably in the weakest state I've ever physically been, and I was able to paddleboard. And I think that's the real beauty of it, is that it's amazing at aiding recovery, because it's not like heavily demanding of you if you're doing it sort of recreationally. But then you start adding, you know, different conditions, different types of water, endurance, speed, and then it becomes a completely different sport. And I think that's also the beauty of it, because you can take paddleboarding at the pace that you want to take it. You know, it's not like you have to go into it and it's going to demand a lot from you. You can choose to take it to that level if you want to, or you can keep it sort of much more calm and sedate and just use it as a way to relax.
And you mentioned there the endurance aspect of the sport, and that's something you're certainly pushing to the limits. And first of all, in 2016, you decided to, you know, paddleboard the length of England. How did that idea come about?
What paddleboarding has done for me, more than anything, is connect me back with the natural world and the environment. And it was by being out on the water on my paddleboard that I really started to understand the problem that our planet is facing with plastic pollution. It was being able to see it right in front of me firsthand, that I thought, oh my goodness, what is happening? And I suppose looking at the bigger picture of it, at the time a lot of people were talking about what was happening in our oceans and ocean health and, you know, the global issue of plastic. And even then in 2016, there wasn't much noise around it, you know, of the public attention that there was, which was very little. It was focused on that. And I was paddling on our canals and rivers in London, and I could see what was happening inland. So really the reason I took on that that sort of big endurance challenge, it was 400 miles, and it was sort of my first ever big paddleboarding expedition, was to highlight plastic pollution. I basically travelled the length of England through our connected waterways from Surrey to the Lake District and photographed every single piece of plastic I saw on my route, and geotagged it in a map so that people could see what I was seeing when I was on the water firsthand. It was my way of bringing a global problem to a sort of very local level.
Of course, and you have a lot since combined your passion for paddleboarding and for the environment as well, and you have set up a company called Plastic Patrol. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that, and how did it start, and what sort of stuff you guys do.
Yeah, so Plastic Patrol really has been an evolution of my environmental campaigning. So when I did my first challenge, the 400 mile challenge, and photographed everything, I just used the hashtag Plastic Patrol to sort of gather all of those images in one place online. And by the time I finished it, completely unexpectedly, because when I first started doing this, I don't think there was, I mean, there wasn't a great deal of public interest or awareness. I think even my family thought I was completely bonkers. But by the time I finished that challenge, after 22 days, it had really snowballed, and I'd had a lot of media interest and a lot of public interest, which was incredible. And people were asking me, you know, how can I help? How can I get involved? How can I support the cause and what you're doing? So later that year, I launched Plastic Patrol as a charity. And I basically take people out paddleboarding all around the UK and more recently in the US, take them out paddleboarding on waterways, canals and rivers, completely free. And the sort of the payment, their nature tax, as I call it, is that they pick up any litter that they see on the water, they pick up any plastic, and they photograph it and they log it on the Plastic Patrol app that I developed, which now combines all of the images that I took on my first journey, plus everything that has been crowdsourced from people supporting the cause all over the world. So we've got about 50,000 images on there from about 22 different countries. And it's not just a great way of understanding where the hotspots and the pressure points are around the world for this problem, but also to start understanding a bit more about the brands that are responsible and ultimately hold them accountable for the plastic that they're continuing to produce.
And when you're out, you know, taking people are out on these paddleboarding trips, do they ever get shocked by the amount of plastic that is in our waters, our oceans, our rivers?
Yeah, absolutely. And almost that's the beauty of being able to take people out on the water. Like, my very own journey started in that exact same way. I was going out paddleboarding to enjoy it and was so horrified by the amount of plastic that I was seeing and the impact that was having on wildlife. You know, coots nests that were made up of more plastic than they were twigs and swans nibbling at wrappers. You know, when you start seeing that, you can't unsee it. And it is, it's really upsetting. So being able to take people out on the water and, you know, giving them a great way to engage with nature, try a new sport, which is brilliant for confidence building, but also connect them firsthand with the issue of the environment, it has so many benefits, because they walk away from that and they want to do something positive and they want to make changes in their life because they have experienced in their own way what that means for the environment.
Of course. And in the last couple of years, you mentioned earlier how, you know, even back in 2016, people weren't massively talking about the plastic problem. Have you noticed sort of a big change, and not just in terms of awareness, but actually people taking action in the last couple of years as well?
Yeah, massively. In the last year, I'd say, after Blue Planet aired their episode around plastic pollution, I feel like there was just this, almost like this light bulb moment where everyone just kind of woke up to the sleepwalk that they'd been in. And, you know, the general public really started to understand what this means and the scale of this problem, and start thinking about how they can tackle it at a sort of a very local level in their own lives.
Yeah, of course. And you mentioned the Blue Planet too. I was going to ask you about that. And in some ways, obviously it was fantastic that they aired it, but is it also slightly worrying that it takes, you know, a TV show to make us aware of just how much damage we as a population, as a race, are doing to our planet?
I don't think so. I think it takes a TV show to highlight that problem, because how else are people going to know? Like, you trust that, or you think you can trust that, you know, materials that are created and made, they've thought about the long-term consequences of these. But obviously, in the case of plastic, that hasn't been done. And I think my worry now is that we start phasing out single-use plastics, which is absolutely what we need to do, but we replace that for other single-use items. And then we start, for example, plastic stirrers, and we replace those with wooden stirrers. That still has an environmental impact. That's wood instead of plastic, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think for me, it's about just single-use culture needs to go. We need to go back to a time where we're thinking about the products we're buying and the reasons we're buying them, and they're built to last.
Yes, of course. And where would you like to see sort of Plastic Patrol Company go from here, the charity? Sorry, you've had so much success already. What are you sort of planning for the future going ahead?
I suppose the Plastic Patrol, what is really key at the moment is being able to invite the general public to just download the app and take photos of any plastic they're seeing anywhere in the world where it shouldn't be, whether that's mountains, beaches, canals, streets, it doesn't matter. The more information we have there, the more we can start to understand what this problem looks like. And like I said earlier, just hold the people responsible, accountable. Like, we've kind of got to a tipping point now where things have to change quickly. And the only way that can change is, one, by us, like, as in us as in the consumer, using our power of purchase to just boycott single-use plastic items and just say, no, you know, we're not going to put up with this anymore. And we're going to use, you know, our spend essentially as a vote, but also to build an evidence base to show the companies, you know, what they're producing, where this is ending up, and the scale of what they're creating, so that they can actually be accountable for what has happened.
And you talk about the scale of where, a scale of plastic problem that's being created. You took Plastic Patrol to America, which is one of the countries in the world that has sort of the biggest pollution issue when it comes to plastic. How was it your spending time over there? Did you have a lot of people helping you out with your cleanups and getting engaged?
Yeah, like you say, America is one of the world's biggest consumers of single-use plastics. And even sort of being out there, I spent a couple of days out there before I started the challenge. Everything's double bagged. Everything is single-use plastic everywhere you look. You know, I feel like they're a couple of years behind where the UK is now in terms of their understanding and awareness of this problem. They're on the same journey, but just slightly sort of slower than us. And I wanted to go there really to draw attention to it a bit more and sort of speed up that process. You know, we're all connected by the same waters ultimately. But what I did find is that, you know, people are engaged with it, and like in the UK, people want to help. They just need to find ways for that to be channeled into support, and that's what Plastic Patrol enables people to do. It gives them a way to get involved and do their bit.
Yes, of course. And There was also a film, I believe, taking place for a short documentary on your journey. So is that sort of going to highlight what you were doing up there and make even more noise about your mission?
Yeah, I think the Hudson Project, the film that we're making, it's that's really the backdrop to talk about the environment, plastic pollution, climate change more generally. So that's being edited at the moment, and I think it's just a way of visually kind of recreating that story and using it as a vehicle to kind of address these problems and explain them a bit more.
And that documentary will also showcase the fact that not only did you do all of your fantastic work, creating awareness and picking up all the litter and, you know, making people aware, but also you paddleboarded the entire length of the Hudson River, which is pretty amazing. I bet you must have felt pretty tired after that.
It was an incredible journey. I think when you're on it, like with these enduring challenges, you almost don't allow yourself to feel tired. It's a very sort of functional process when you're doing it, because you've got to keep going and you know you've got to keep going. So by the time you finish, it's just all that adrenaline. It's just kind of, you know, it sort of slowly fades away and you're like, actually, I'm really ached now. Everything hurts right now and I'm exhausted. So, yeah, by the time I finished, I was pretty exhausted.
And how do you mentally and physically prepare yourself for a challenge of that magnitude?
Physically, I think it's, for me, just about spending as much time trying to replicate the conditions I expect to find on the water. And probably a bit like marathon training when it's long distances, you're just sort of packing in the miles, building up your time, so that your muscle memory's there and you're prepared for it, but also refining technique and making sure that I'm paddling in a way that is most efficient. And then mentally, I still don't know the answer to that. I don't know how I prepare mentally. In some ways, I probably don't prepare mentally, because if you think about it too much, you start to feel quite fearful, and it sort of almost fought yourself out of doing things. But certainly physically, I think, you know, that you always need to train and make sure that you're capable. That, for me, feeling strong gives me confidence, and I sort of feel that I know if I get into some really hairy situations, I feel physically capable enough of dealing with those.
And I mean, physically hairy situations. Am I right in thinking that you had Hurricane Florence knocking about at the same time?
Yeah, it was such bad timing. For two weeks, I think it was, maybe longer, before I arrived, New York was blessed with, you know, glorious blue skies, really, you know, really warm, hot sunshine, calm, no winds. And the morning I started the challenge, it was exactly the same. And I thought, oh, this is great. This is going to be like a good paddle. If I time it right with tides and currents, you know, this will be beautiful. And then about 2 hours after I started on day one, the first of 8 days of horrific, unpredictable weather started. And there was a thunderstorm and I was on the water and it was really hard to get off the water somewhere safe. And I just, you know, it's just really uncomfortable in those situations. And obviously I didn't have any support on the water with me, so I could just jump in a boat and be whisked off to shore. It definitely makes it more of an adventure, but it was quite scary at moments, that's for sure.
Yeah, it certainly sounds it. Did you get to enjoy much of America after the challenge was complete?
So I finished my challenge at the Statue of Liberty, which obviously is amazingly iconic and, you know, such a special way to end this journey. But it was also the start of the APP World Tour, which is basically a world tour for paddle sports, and they bring it to cities all over the world. So when I finished, I was there for that weekend, that festival, which was incredible, because it was just paddlers, amateurs and professionals from all over the world that come to New York City to kind of enjoy paddling around the Hudson. So yeah, it was a really great way to end it.
And it certainly sounds it. And final question from me as well. It also, you have you have a book coming out very, very soon. So just wondering if you could just tell us a bit more about it and what we can expect to read in it.
Yeah, so the book actually, it's a guidebook, 50 favourite places to paddle around the UK. I think I've spent a lot of time on the water in England, partly for training, partly for pleasure, just exploring. Paddleboarding has been a great way for me to explore the beauty of England, and obviously that 400 mile challenge I did through England exposed me to a lot of beautiful waterways that we have that are just almost untouched. And I think this book was a way of me just kind of sharing the places that I've discovered and found, and sort of, you know, guiding people along on their own paddling journeys and showcasing actually the best of British nature, but from a really new perspective.
And when can we expect to see the books on our shelves?
I think it comes out on the 25th of October, so not long.
Yeah, less than a month, so we certainly, Alistair and I, can't wait to have a look at that. And I'm going to put you on the spot here, sorry, for one final question, but if you just have one quick message out there for people who are maybe going through tough times like you were, or looking for a new purpose in life, a new adventure, sort of what would you say to them to inspire them?
Don't overthink stuff, like just follow your heart and follow what you want. I think for me, the way that my journey has transpired is very much that after I'd quit my job and I had no idea what I wanted to do and how my life would work out, I just sort of was guided by what I was passionate about, and actually I spent time paddleboarding to work out what I wanted to do and give myself like the mental space to do that, and actually paddleboarding ended up being what I spent my life doing. I think people just need to sort of go easy on themselves a little bit and just allow themselves the freedom to think about what they want.
And I think that is the perfect note to end a really fantastic interview on. Thank you so much, Lizzie, for coming on. It's been, alongside our mental health specials, one of the most important, I think, interviews we've been fortunate to do on sports. But, you know, we need to be aware of the amount of plastic pollution. We need to make changes. So thank you for all the fantastic work you've done and for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
You're listening to Sportspiel, available on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. As always, it's a big thank you to Lizzie Carr, like we say to all of our guests, for coming on. Hope everyone enjoyed the interview, but now it's time for part two of the show and time to delve into our new news roundup section. So the way this is going to work is we've both got 5 news stories each, and we will go back and forth giving a brief rundown of what it is and have a little chat about it if necessary. The idea behind it is to give you some of the big headlines that have happened in sports news recently, as well as some of the ones that may have passed you by, which shouldn't really have because they are quite important, we feel. The first one, however, that I'm going to mention is a big story that has done the rounds quite recently, and that is the Cristiano Ronaldo rape case. And this is a story I really think should be bigger, but undoubtedly everyone has heard, in that Portugal and Juventus football superstar Cristiano Ronaldo has been accused of rape. The allegation dates back to 2009, where American Catherine Mayorga claimed the footballer had raped her in a Las Vegas hotel suite. The accusations appeared in German publication Der Spiegel, who also reported that Ronaldo and his legal team settled out of court with Mayorga at the time. Ronaldo has denied the accusations, calling it fake news, but I don't know, have you had any opinion on the style of reporting or what it was?
I mean, my main thing is about this is I really hope it isn't true in some ways, because, you know, I've always backed Ronaldo up personally, so it'd make me look like an idiot, but also, you know, it'd really just change our view and so many things if he has found to have done it, but also, you know, if he has done this, then the truth needs to come out. We can't be hiding this, but it's just one of those where I'm really torn as to over.
I just have two issues with the fallout of it, mainly the people who are very quick to condemn him, but also the people who are very quick to support him, namely his club Juventus.
That tweet by Juventus was embarrassing,
where he said he's shown great professionalism and dedication, as if that's some kind of link between how that it doesn't matter how you are on the pitch, you could be totally different off the pitch, but also fans of him as well, just because he's good at scoring goals, that in no way dictates what happens off the pitch. All that anyone should want now is that there's a thorough investigation. That should be all that matters, rather than just this verbal slangy match on social media.
Do you think he should be playing while it's going on?
He hasn't been charged with anything for now. If he is charged, then no. But for now, I think it's okay.
What we didn't mention is that we're also timing each other on these stories. So 2 minutes max. That was 1:45. Good start from you. Now it's my turn on the timer. So my first story is also with football. It's also with a Champions League team, or two Champions League teams. Some of you may have seen this week that there is a French criminal financial investigation underway over reports of alleged match fixing between Paris Saint-Germain and Red Star Belgrade. That Champions League game took place earlier this month. PSG won 6-1. And L'Equipe, the French newspaper, have reported that a Red Star official placed a bet of just under 5 million euros on his side to lose by 5 goals. Red Star have completely rejected the story. They've said in the statement, we regard the statement with the highest anger and abomination and reject the story.
Abomination is a good
abomination
word.
Abomination is a fantastic word. Red Star expects to get the truth at short notice and remove any doubt. PSG also replied with their amazement and indignation that such a thing could have gone on. But the reportings were passed on by UEFA, so to the French judiciary system. Again, I really hope this isn't true, although it could do Liverpool a favour in their group in the Champions League. But
really, any sort of corruption we could do without in a UEFA competition?
Well, in any sort of football, I mean, you know, you've always got match-fixing threats in cricket. There's always some sort of spot-fixing going on, and we've had the official referee issues in Italy over the last few years, and let's just hope that, you know, one of the biggest tournaments in the world isn't being infiltrated by gambling and corruption as well.
That would be nice. Next story from me, and it's quite a big one considering we focused a lot on the funding aspect of sport, UK sport, in on this podcast, and that's the news that this week sports which currently don't receive funding from UK sport will be able to apply for up to £500,000 of financial help from a new aspiration fund which has been set up by the government. Paralympic sports are also eligible to apply, with Sports Minister Tracy Crouch saying the fund, that is £3 million in total, will enable more athletes to inspire the nation. Good thing, I think, overall, but David Pond, who is the chief executive of British Wheelchair Rugby, he said any additional funding will obviously help us, but the reality is next year I need to raise £400,000 to help us prepare properly for the 2020 Paralympics. Wheelchair rugby was one of the sports that lost all of its UK sport funding after Rio 2016. I think they finished fifth at that Paralympics. So to me, it kind of strikes as too little, too late, I think. It's a nice initiative, and obviously would be great to have more people given the chance to represent their country at an Olympics. But the fact is, there are a lot of sports out there that don't receive funding that need it desperately at this point in time.
Just feels like if you're going to do that, you should be doing that 6 months maximum after a Games is finished, at the start of a new cycle, not
exactly
halfway through.
Rather than, yeah, we're in 2018 now, nearly 2019. So there's not much time left if people want to get to the 2020 Olympic Games.
Very true. My next story, it also focuses on a new measures brought in by UK Sport and the English Institute of Sport this week, and they are new mental health measures designed to help athletes deal with mental health issues. And this was announced on World Mental Health Day this week, which we did a big thing for, sharing all of our mental health specials
back from
and our
May time.
It's Okay Not to Be Okay videos. So Catherine Granger, head sort of the UK Sport, announced this, trying to produce a positive mental health environment, and we'll focus on four areas. So this is education, provision, communication and assurance. I think for me, and I assume for you as well, education is something that's so key on mental health at the moment. We need to learn so much. You know, there's so much we can all learn about mental health, even those of us who've suffered with it. You know, there's so much more room for us to, you know, acquire new information, and there's so much we don't know. So this is, I think it's a very good program, and there will also be mental health screening sessions for athletes and staff joining and leaving the elite setups, which I think is crucial for, you know, a lot of athletes who've stepped away from elite sport talk about the lack of help they've received once they step away. So to have this mental health screening, you know, it's a start to, you know, if they need the help that they can get it. It's not going to be the end result, I don't think, and there'll be other things need to be put in place, but it's a good measure, and hopefully, you know, we'll see less of these sort of allegations of bullying and mental health issues in sports such as para swimming and canoeing and rowing that we've been seeing over the last few years.
Yeah, we have seen a lot of that. So any program or initiative to improve that and improve the education of it, look at Marvin Sordell's story, for example, when he's still playing. Anything to improve that is a good thing, I think. Next up from me, Usain Bolt, our favourite sprinter, of course, and the world record holding Olympic champion, Mr. Charisma himself. He managed to grab 2 goals in his first start for a professional football team, that team being Australian side Central Coast Mariners. 32-year-old Bolt scored the 3rd and 4th goals in a 4-0 win over Macarthur South West and naturally he celebrated with a lightning pose. That was a friendly game, so obviously the occasion doesn't get much bigger. He's also got 95 on his shirt in reference to his world record time, so that's just Usain Bolt all over, really. He joined the club in August for a, quote, indefinite training period, whatever that is. But they do, of course, have the same sponsor, so I think we can clearly see why he managed to get a place at that football team. That's a cynical side of me saying that, but hey-ho, it's not bothering anyone. He said it was his dream to be a professional footballer once he finished sprinting, so good on him.
His first goal was pretty neat as well. He took that really well.
The goalkeeper should save that. I'm sorry.
The second goal was slightly more questionable, but...
If there's anything, he's got the pace on defenders. I will say that. Technique might still
he looks like he knows where the goal is. It'd be really interesting
to see.
Did
you see him playing Soccer Aid, by the way?
No.
It had his moments, but as I was saying, he's got pace, but the technical ability is maybe a little bit off where it should be.
Well, we'll see. I sort of hope he gets a contract just to see how he does. It'd be very funny.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to lower the tone slightly, I'm afraid, and revisit one of our favourite topics, which is drugs. So
some things never change.
As we spoke about at great length in our last episode, Russia have not completely been reinstated yet, but are well on the way to being reinstated to Olympic sports following WADA's decision. But there was all sorts of issues with how that's come about in terms of, you know, special meetings and not having to meet the full requirements and things like that. And a story came out this week which is really worrying. So the former chair of the WADA Athlete Committee, Becky Scott, is accusing some of the organisation's most senior officials of bullying around the reinstatement. She's been subjected to inappropriate comments and gestures by some senior members of the executive committee. This came after she resigned in protest at the controversial recommendation to end the Russian ban. She didn't like the compromise. She came out and gave a very stark interview to BBC Sport this week, saying, you know, just how bad things were, and that, you know, some of the biggest names in WADA just let these comments happen. They just sat back and literally watched them, and they didn't step in.
Just to chime in, we retweeted that on our Twitter feed as well, so if people want to go watch it, it's there.
I think one thing she said was, this was before she resigned, she went into a meeting to object about the reinstation. She said, I felt an intense amount of pressure going into that meeting. There was laughter when I read out the list of athlete committees who were confronting the decision. At the time, it was upsetting, and on reflection, it's a tactic and manoeuvre and born out of a long-standing belief that athletes don't have to be part of this conversation. So she is a three-time Winter Olympian herself, and I think the feeling is that WADA are only taking the opinions of people who wear the suits and ties seriously, rather than the athletes who make up many of their committees and are ultimately, you know, they're the voices we actually should be listening to.
That's the point we raised last time, is that the power and influence is essentially what made this decision to bring them back into the fold. And if her accusations, considering the serious nature of them, they really should be investigated, I think. Also, what's the point of having your athlete's voice on that board if you're not going to take them into account? Enough said.
Our former guest, Laura Deasy, is one of many who have come out in support of Becky over the last week or so, and there's a lot of division at the moment between WADA and its athletes, and it's worrying. It's really, really worrying, but we shall see what happens. Politics is taking over sport again.
Again. Next story up for me is Stockholm and their bid for the 2026 Winter Olympics. As reported by Swedish media, their bid is in serious doubt after the city council's two newly merged parties agreed they will not host the games. There's a bit of a political upheaval in Sweden at the moment. They have a hung parliament, and then the city council is now a coalition. However, bid leaders have said that they will continue with their Winter Olympics bid. That news came 3 days after the IOC voted to shortlist Stockholm as one of three candidates for the Games, along with Calgary and a joint bid from Milan, Cortina d'Ampezzo. There's my Italian pronunciation for you. But those two other bids also have their own issues. Namely, Calgary faces a key public vote next month, which will be on November the 13th. The bid leaders are confident of a positive result in that, but who knows with elections these days? And the Milan Cortina also has problems in that the Italian government have refused to underwrite the bid while Turin was initially due to be part of that bid before it dropped out after a row over who should be the lead city. The Italian National Olympic Committee president even, however, said this wouldn't be an issue as Milan and Cortina have enough financial might to fund the project. But that always fills me a little bit with worry when people make those promises and then later down the line, once you actually start building your venues, suddenly all manner of things can go wrong.
It's just the way at the moment with these multi-event
no one seems keen to take them on.
Because of the financial strain. I mean, you look at what China did, you look at what London did. Some incredible... both were incredible spectacles, but how do you live up to that?
Exactly.
It's so difficult.
The next key date in that story, by the way, will be January 11th, which is the submission of the candidature files. So we'll probably know more about where this is going and whether the 2026 Winter Olympics will be held after that date.
Sticking on an Olympic theme, this week has seen the Youth Olympics taking place in Argentina.
Someone loved the breakdancing, didn't they? It's a sport.
I'm not talking about it. But one sport that Britain has had success in is the show jumping, which was actually a mixed country event. It was Europe versus America versus Africa versus Asia. And we had, or GB had a rider in that, Jack Whittaker, won a silver medal. And emulating his dad, who 34 years ago was part of the team of jumping event side that picked up a silver at the 1984 LA Games. And there's good hope that, you know, Jack can go on and make a senior Olympics and emulate his dad. And I did some interesting, there's some interesting stats in terms of parent, child, Olympic medalists combinations. There's 8 in total, as well as the Shears, who are grandson and grandfather, obviously, who won Winter Olympic medals between them. So Jack Shear won 2 golds in speed skating in 1932, and his grandson Jimmy won skeleton gold in 2002. There's also been, in the Summer Olympics, a history of hockey medals for the Keller family, starting with Erwin Keller winning a silver in 1936. His son Carsten won gold in 1972. And then his 2 grandsons, Andreas and Florian, have both won medals. And granddaughter Natasha won silver at 2004. In terms of British, there's only ever been one parent-child combination, both winning medals, and that is Zara and Mike Phillips. Mike won 2 medals, 1 gold at 1972 and 1988, and Zara picked up, famously, a silver medal in 2012. So could we see another equestrian family making the list very soon? Jack Whittaker is an exciting prospect.
Yes. Final story from me, and that is a new women's tour of Scotland. So the country is set to be at the forefront of the growth in women's cycling as the UCI announced a new professional race which will debut in August 2019, dubbed the Women's Tour of Scotland. The race will play part of an annual cycling festival across Scotland that will combine a multi-day professional stage race for the women's peloton with a new 5,000 rider strong sportive to tackle some of the same roads. The dates for the event have been set as Friday 9th to Sunday 11th of August, 1 week after Ride London Classic, so that means there should be plenty of riders who are able to take part in that. But the route is yet to be finalised. Great news for Scotland, I think. Obviously, I'm biased because I used to live there, but the landscape is going to look great. So from a Scottish tourist board's point of view, that's going to be one hell of a good showpiece to display what that country has to offer. From a women's cycling perspective, still wondering where this women's grand tour is, because you got to look at the men, you've got your Tour de France, your Vuelta, the Giro d'Italia as well. And I know some people are thinking, why can't the women have a tour like that as well?
Well, it's just been
a bigger question, perhaps.
Been interesting, literally, just by coincidence, on the way here, I was reading a book by Sarah Shepherd called Kicking Off, and I was actually on a section where they were talking about professional women's racing, and it was interesting how that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, there were so many professional races, but it's a sport that's gone backwards because there's just no consistency, no funding, teams are drying up. Events are drying up. There used to be a women's equivalent of the Tour de France that stopped in 2009. They do now have a race on the morning of the final stage, which is broadcast on TV, which is hopefully going to progress into something bigger. But women's cycling is a sport that's gone backwards. So let's hope that this tour in Scotland can really kick on and
reignite something.
Reignite that, because, you know, track cycling is track cycling is really popular sport for women. So should road cycling. Apologies, that was my duck timer going off. Final story from me is that Mick Schumacher, son of the legend that is Michael Schumacher, this weekend became the European Formula 3 champion. Did so with one race to spare, beating Dan Ticktum, Britain's Dan Ticktum, on the Red Bull driver program. Very highly rated driver. There was a lot of caution over Mick Schumacher initially, you know, whether he was only buying drives that made him look good, and whether he actually had any pace. But this season, he's proved he's got good racecraft, good speed. Looks like a really, really decent racer. And since its inception in 2012, the European F3 has seen a whole host of its winners go on to compete in Formula 1. So in 2017, Lando Norris was the winner. He's now going to be driving at McLaren next season. 2016, Lance Stroll. I mean, admittedly, there's some questions over actually how good he is, and it. But George Russell came third that season, and he's now going to be at Williams next year. He's a very good racer. Year before that, Antonio Giovinazzi and Charles Leclerc came second and fourth. They're going to be at Sauber and Ferrari, respectively, next year. Esteban Ocon in 2014, one of the biggest stars in F1 at the moment. Max Verstappen came third that year. And in its first season, 2012, Carlos Sainz Jr. also competed well. So I think the fact that he's won this championship against some really decent young racers in there proves that Mick Schumacher could well make F1 in the next few years, which would be incredible, really, to see another Schumacher in the sport. And I know wherever Michael is and however he's doing, I know he'll be immensely proud of his son.
Exactly. There's a whole worth of talent in that name. So he's hoping that it actually develops the way we want it to. But that is it for the news roundup. More to come after this. Follow Sportspiel Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram, or go to our website, sportspielonline.com. On to this week's topic of discussion, the W Series. Next year, motor racing will have a new series, an all-female driver competition designed to promote and provide a stepping stone to overcome the huge gender gap that currently exists in the sport. Motor racing is one of the few sports where men and women can compete on a level playing field, but you wouldn't really know that with men predominantly taking up the available driving seat on offer. Look at Formula One, for example. 900 drivers have competed since it began in 1950, but two have been women. The last official appearance was Lela Lombardi in 1976, although South Africa's Desiree Wilson raced for Tyrrell in a non-championship meeting in 1981. Yet the news of the arrival of the W Series, which has backers including David Coulthard, Red Bull technical director Adrian Newey, and Lewis Hamilton's former sporting director at McLaren, Dave Ryan, hasn't been met with overwhelming positivity. So I start with a big whopper of a question. Is the W Series sexist?
I wasn't expecting that question to come my way, but before I answer that very quickly, can I just say it's Tyrrell, not Tyrrell.
Tyrrell crisps.
No, they're Tyrrell crisps.
Are they?
It's the Tyrrell Premier 15s. Anyway, we digress.
Who cares about
Is it sexist? In my opinion, no. Motorsport is a sport, as we were mentioning with cycling earlier, that's gone backwards in terms of its gender equality in recent years. So back in the day, you know, you did have a few women coming through. You had Marisa, Teresa De Filippis, who competed in the late 50s. You had Leila Lombardi in the 70s. You had Davina Galica, who never qualified for a race but did try in the late 70s. Desiree Wilson didn't qualify but tried in 1980. And then Giovanna Amati in 1992, again, didn't qualify but tried to make her a grid. But then since then, no one has actually even, you know, bothered. Not bothered, but no one's been given the opportunity to try. We've had a number of test drivers in the noughties. Catherine Legge, Susie Wolf, Maria De Viotta, Tatiana Calderon. But apart from that, you know, there hasn't...
No one's come close.
And you look at the number of women in decent single-seater racing series. I'm not going to include sports car because it's a different element and that's sort of more racing in America. You've had Pippa Mann in IndyCar over the last few years, has been given a few opportunities but has never really shone. You've got Tatiana Calderon, previously mentioned, in GP3, doing, you know, okay. She's also the Sauber test driver this year. You've got Sophia Flush, who's in the European F3 series racing against the aforementioned Mick Schumacher. Again, she's very young, but she had a decent year. And then you had Jamie Chadwick racing in the British Formula 3 alongside Billy Monger this year. Became the first woman ever to win a race in that category. So, apart from that, women in good, high-quality single-seat series in Europe doesn't really exist. So I think actually giving them this opportunity to race in cars that are all equal, so this is basically purely going to be on racing speed and racecraft, you know, six races, it's going to be alongside DTM and the new F3 GP3 series, so it's going to have an audience already there to watch, it's going to have good coverage, and the fact is, you know, they don't have to solely race in this series, you know, they can go and do other series as well across the season, just have to make sure they're available for these six weekends. So I think it could be a good thing. Either way, I think it's going to fold after 6 or 7 years, because either it will have had the desired outcome and women will be getting more chances in single-seater series, or it will flop either way. So I think, you know, give it a go, let it run its course, see what happens. But is it sexist? No, I don't think so. I think a change was needed to get more women in motorsport. This is a drastic measure, but it might yet pay off. So I think we need to just sort of sit back and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned Pippa Mann, who is one of the key opposition voices in this, because on the day it was announced, she tweeted, "I am deeply disappointed to see such a historic step backwards take place in my lifetime. What a sad day for motorsport. Those with funding to help female racers are choosing to segregate them as opposed to supporting them." So then bring in your point about the fact that you think it will be no more in 6 or 7 years, for whatever reason. Why is the money that is being invested in this event not being invested in helping female racers up the ladder?
No one has ever really given female racers enough of an opportunity, and it has always been seen as a bold move to fund a women's racer who you've never quite sure how they're going to compete because they just haven't been given the opportunity before.
So is that a mental thing? Why is it such a bold move to give a female racer who might have that ability the backing necessary as opposed to a male racer who may or may not have that ability?
It's a gamble, but it's a gamble that you don't know that will pay off, whereas with male racers, you know roughly how far they can get, but it's just such an unknown. It sounds ridiculous as I'm saying it. I'm trying to justify it, but I can't really.
Or is it because there's so few of them?
There are a few, but I think there are more than you think. There are a lot of girls in karting, but they just don't get the chance.
That's why I just don't understand.
Through.
Why is the backing not there?
Part of the reason there aren't any role models for them to look up to. So this is why people like Jamie Chadwick are so crucial now that we get her as much media coverage as possible to encourage more women to come through. It's been a vicious cycle over these few years. Mm-hmm. That needs to change.
I mean, I'll throw this in because Catherine Bonmuir, who is the chief executive of the W Series, she said that the aim of it was to show the world just what women are really capable of. But then surely they can do that anyway. If they got the chance to race in the pre-existing classifications that are there alongside men with the right backing, isn't that a perfect, arguably better way of showcasing what they do?
They're not getting the chances. If they do get drives, they're often in uncompetitive, lower down the grid cars because those at the very top are wanting to sign the very best racers who they've seen previously can race really quickly, and for whatever reason, those aren't women.
So I kind of see it.
Motorsport as an industry is so behind the times, so backwards, and arguably motorsport has been sexist for a long time, and some people may see this move to create a women's only series as, you know, another example of that sexism, but it could work, it could have the desired effect. I think the whole debate we're having, we just need to actually just get on with it really and just see what happens. I think Pippa Mann, as someone who's had a long career in motorsport and has been subjected to sexism for so long, that she's not confident that change can happen like this. But the younger drivers coming through, like your Chadwick, like your Alice Powell, your Stephanie Cox, your Vicky Pariah, these younger drivers are looking forward to it because they've not had that level of sexism thrown their way for as long. I think so it's more designed for the younger races. I genuinely cannot predict how it's going to come out, how it's going to work, but a change was needed. They've made a change. Let them fall on their own sword if it's going to flop.
Because the way I see it is kind of another element of positive discrimination, which, to pick a politics reference, such as all women shortlists for seats in on a council or for parliament, whatever. And that's the same reason I've always been against all women shortlists, because I've always felt you should be the best person available, regardless of your gender. Likewise, if you've got the best talent, regardless of your gender, you should be getting that same level of support that anyone else would. We were talking before we started recording about Lance Stroll. Love him or hate him, we, I think, agree that he's not the most talented of F1 drivers out there. But he has been helped by the fact that he does have a very wealthy father who has a very keen interest in motorsport. And that I find perennially frustrating, that because of the great position he's found himself in with the support and backing, it just needs someone or a few people to channel their funds into giving a promising young female driver, not even young, just a promising driver, that support to give them the opportunity to show what they can do.
But there hasn't been anyone like that in motorsport for years.
Because we mentioned again, the prize fund for this is what, 1.15 million? That's the entire prize fund, yes. But there's a lot of money going into this series that could be channeled into supporting someone. They've got the money. It's just putting it somewhere. Is it a way for people to think, here's what we've created for women, our conscience is clear now?
I don't think it's that cynical. I think the thinking behind it is genuinely they want to help women have more opportunities in motor racing. It feels like it's a fairly genuine trying to help. But are they doing it in the right way? That's what we'll find out in time.
That's kind of my overall point. It's tackling the right thing. You're tackling the right question, but you're doing it the wrong way, personally. And if you think it's going to fold in 6 or 7 years, then why bother?
Because it could be a good starting block. But that's the whole thing. It could be. It's not a definite it will or it won't be. It's
going to be a time will tell, isn't it?
I think the fact is that they're going to give all the women the same cars, like exactly the same spec, so it will literally be whoever is the quickest will win, and that should hopefully appeal to someone out there to give them a chance. And the fact is they're doing it alongside DTM, so they're gonna, as I said previously, they're gonna have an audience, they're gonna have coverage. It's only 6 races a year. They can spend the rest of their time in other series, you know, racing alongside the men as well, getting coverage and getting exposure and racecraft that way. So I think it's positive.
Right, that is nearly it from us. Some final messages before we pack up. Social media, as ever, you can go and follow us on that. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. All of our handles are SportsSpielPod, and you can always get in touch with us. Our email is sportsspielpod@gmail.com. One thing, Thursday, where are we going this upcoming Thursday?
We are heading back to the place that began this whole yes. journey, going back to News Associates to give a talk on podcasting, which yes. should be entertaining.
So if you're by any chance on that News Associates course that we're going to talk to, we'll try and make it professional. But it's the first time we've ever done anything like this. We're coming full circle.
Feel free to ask us plenty of questions, because we will try and answer them.
We will do our best to answer them. So yeah, that's this upcoming Thursday, the 18th. Going to be weird, but kind of looking forward to it. We are going to be back next in 2 weeks' time, which is the 28th of October, which, as my calendar tells me, is when British summertime ends.
At least we get an extra hour in bed that morning.
Yeah, but get your winter woolies out, because it's going to get colder. And with that, that is the end of this latest episode of Sportspiel. We hope you liked it, and do let us know, of course, what you think of the new format from me and from Will. It's goodbye, listeners. Until next time, we'll see you soon.